Well, thanks for giving me a welcome there, fellas. Good to see you again. You don't look like you did in high school. Not to me. Look like you're growing up there, boy. What a beautiful place. This could be St. Petersburg, Russia, for all I know. Thanks for having us here in this wonderful place, whoever's responsible. Well, I love getting with men. That's my thing, you know? And I'm sensing a lot of testosterone in this room today, you know? And every time I get with a bunch of revved up guys like you, I always think of this old story about these three bulls. And there was kind of a senior bull on this farm, and then there was his assistant bull, and then they got a little junior bull in there. And word came down through the grapevine that they were getting a fourth bull the next day. And they were talking it over, and they didn't like it. And this senior bull, he said, "You know what? I got about 200 heifers out there that I take care of, and I just don't think I feel like sharing any of them because I think I do a good job, and we don't need another bull around here." Well, a junior bull said, assistant bull said, "Well, I ain't got that many, but I got 35, and I just don't think I have any to share. I think I do quite a good job with them." Well, a little brand new junior bull said, "Well, gee, I'm just getting started out here. I got about 10. I don't think I have any to share. We don't need a new bull. Ain't going to be nice to him. Who cares?" Well, the next day, about 10 o'clock, a big 18-wheeler comes driving up. Air brakes bleed. Steel ramp comes down. And this giant walks off this truck. Stands there, neck just shining in the sun. He looks out there and just kind of surveys those 250 heifers. Mm-hmm. And then kind of looks over there at those three bulls. About that time, a senior bull said, "You know, fellas, I think I might have spoken too hastily about, not cooperating. We got to learn to get along in this world. Certainly, I could figure a way to, share a few heifers with this fine gentleman here." Junior bull said, "You the boss, I'm just following your lead. Yeah, we got to get along in this world. I'm going to share a few." About that time, they looked over and the junior bull's going like this. Senior bull said, "You idiot. If you fight that thing, it'll kill you." He said, "Fight it. I ain't going to fight it. I just want the thing to know I'm a bull." Amen, buddy. You don't think I feel that way when I go out to Redskins Park? "How you men doing?" I mean. A friend of mine in Washington was Steve Largent, who was a pretty good player in his own right, real man of faith, lover of Jesus. But you know, when you're around NFL football players, I was with our team after the Tampa Bay game, and it was Coach Gibbs' first win since he's been back. It's been a rough year. I've become a real man of faith this year. I told him, "I'm running out of wilderness and desert messages, Coach. It'd be good if y'all could win so I could give you those how to be humble messages that we all love to give." But I just remember going in trying to hug Chris Samuels from Alabama after the game, and I just ended up patting him on the shoulder like that. He's just a walking building. They're just huge. But I want to tell you something. One of the days around Washington and around this country that we'll always remember will be 9/11. When John Kennedy was shot, I know where I was. I was in Mr. Griswold's science class at Cloverdale Junior High in Montgomery. I remember the instant they came over the loudspeaker and told us about President Kennedy. And I'm sure all of you know exactly where you were on 9/11. I was at the White House counseling a guy, and we looked up and the kitchen staff was sprinting across the lawn out of the kitchen. That's a sight I've never seen up there in 20 years. And this fella made light of it. He said, "You know, there must be a grease fire down there in the White House kitchen." And we're kind of chuckling. I didn't know what they were doing down there. Then I looked up and I saw professional men and women from the old administration building, that beautiful Victorian building you've probably seen if you've been to Washington on the corner, and hundreds of them in their business suits, men and women, were sprinting out and headed down the street. We had no idea what was happening. Well, I'm not a news junkie because when I want to know something, You know, one of the groups I lead is a journalist group. Britt Hume's in there, Fred Barnes, Tony Snow, Mort, all these guys. So I just call them up. I don't bother to read a newspaper. I just get them on the phone and go, what's the deal? And I got Fred Barnes on the phone, and he told me what was happening. So we headed out, and it was like a Superman movie. People were looking up, running down the street, not having a clue, and this big airliner passed overhead. They tell me that was the, and I thought, what is that thing doing in this airspace? And they tell me that was the one that eventually hit the Pentagon. Don't know, but that's what they tell me. The thought was the original target was the White House itself. Had it hit that initial target, I certainly wouldn't be speaking with you today. But there's been a spiritual hunger. I don't know about Birmingham, but my guess is it's not that much different down here. Since that day, all the years we've been in Washington, there's a spiritual hunger there that has not left to this day. I teach about 8 or 9 groups of men. I can't even add another group right now. All the guys aren't saying they are believers. They're not convinced believers, but they want in. And they're sincerely asking questions like this, not just because some preacher told them to, it's because they want to know. And the questions are, what really matters in life? How can I connect with God? How can I really make my life count? Because a lot of this stuff we used to think was so important, in light of what's going on, it just doesn't seem to matter that much, does it? You know, just after that attack, I was in New York City, and I met some real heroes to me from the New York City Fire Department. You know the thing about those guys that I want to talk to you a little bit about this morning? It's a way of thinking, fellas. I want you to open your hearts. I don't want anything from you, but I'm just here to stir you. I'm going to ask you to open your hearts and really examine yourself. What kind of man are you? I told a little joke about bulls, but what kind of man are you? Now back to Steve Largent. You thought I forgot about him? When you stand around heroes, when you stand around warriors, or when you stand around NFL players, I remember at one point Newt Gingrich was trying to bully Steve around. And they sat in a little caucus room up at the Capitol. And one of the fellas there told me that that Mr. Gingrich was at one point, if I have my story straight, trying to intimidate Steve into going along with his way. And Largent had a classic line. He said, Mr. Speaker, I've been in much smaller rooms with guys a lot bigger than you are. And if they didn't intimidate me, I don't think you can either. Now, Steve's a real warrior. He knows who he is. His life is counting, and he has power in his life. He's a leader. Everyone here today is called to lead in some fashion, every one of you. And I'm here to just kind of let us pause for a minute, and you look at yourself and try to answer to yourself before you walk out of here, are you doing it? Have you stepped up to the plate? Are you doing your part? Because you know a lot of people, they're not going to help do anything. They're just going to waste their life, or they're going to sell out for something that really doesn't matter. Now back to the New York City firemen. You know, the thing about them that has inspired me, and I think it's life-defining for me, is in that moment when everybody was trying to get out of those buildings, which way were they headed? They were headed in. You know, it's a shame people have tried to take Christianity and make it just such a comfortable deal, isn't it? Ministers even going around saying if you really trust Jesus, you'll be happy, happy, happy all the time, time, time. Your batting average will go up. Your bank account will go up. That's all nonsense in my opinion. I tell you, you get serious about being a man, being a warrior, being a leader, your life may get a lot harder, not easier. The Lord may call on you men as you lead your families and try to influence your friends, whatever organizations you lead, whatever group of people that you're accountable to shepherd and lead. He may call you from time to time to run in a building when everybody else wants out. Now, God can use any situation, even that horrendous disaster. There is a man up in New York I know who told me a story about these two gals that worked on the 70th floor in one of the towers. And the one gal was always trying to lead her friend to a personal relationship in Christ. But because it was a politically correct environment, they couldn't use the biblical language. So her code for is, you better give your life to the Lord, was, girl, you better get on the bus. Did I tell you? Every time somebody make a good point, hear her. Did I tell you? Get on the bus. What are you waiting on? This guy told me he knew these two women. And when the plane hit, they got in a stairwell and somehow they made it down 70 flights. Got out of that building and thought they were saved. And all of a sudden, you remember the shots when those buildings came down? It was just like a tidal wave of steel and stuff, just rushing through the buildings, like the ocean. And here these gals see that and they're running again, the second time for their life. They turn the corner and lo and behold, there's a New York City Transit bus sitting there. They dive in that thing and it's covered. They found them about a day later, both alive. The one gal told me, her friend said, "Gal, I'm on the bus." Why does it always have to get to that before we get off the dime? Now, when you talk about leadership, there are some men who are going to help win the war, and there are some men who are just never going to really do anything. What kind of man are you? What kind of man am I? One of the great leaders to me wrote one of the best letters I've ever seen in my life. This is close to me because my father was an airborne ranger. My father was in the 82nd Airborne. One of the first drops, the first drop in the history of modern warfare, was over North Africa, and my father went out the plane that day and he was personally reviewed by General Patton. He dropped into Sicily, fought in the battles of Naples Foggia, the Battle of the Rhineland, Winter Garden, went into Holland in a glider at night. June 1944, my father was at Utah Beach with the Rangers. That's right out of a movie, isn't it? You know, when you look at people of faith, it's a shame there again. So many ministers have asked men just to become sweet guys for Jesus. But if Paul, the great apostle, were here today, he was an airborne ranger. In 2 Timothy 2, he says, "Endure hardship with me as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." So when our commander-in-chief comes, he can say, "Well done." Listen to this letter as we approach Christmas season. This letter was written December 24th, 1944. It's from the headquarters of the 101st Airborne Division. You know who those guys were, don't you? The 101st Airborne, the Screaming Eagles. HBO just did a 10-part series a few years ago on these guys. It's men like this that help win wars. Don't know if you've noticed it yet, but we're in a spiritual warfare in this country. Now, which side of it are you going to be on, fellas? And are you going to do anything to help win it? This is Christmas Eve, snowy, freezing conditions. What a leader. This is from Commander McAuliffe. A letter to all the troops of the 101st Airborne on Christmas Eve, 1944. "Well, what's merry about all this, you ask? We're fighting, it's cold, and we're not home. All true, but what has the proud Eagle Division accomplished with its worthy comrades and the 10th Armored Division and the 705th Tank Destroyer Battalion and with all the rest? Just this. We have stopped cold everything that has been thrown at us from the north, east, south, and west. We have identifications from 4 German panzer divisions, 2 German infantry divisions, and 1 German parachute division. These units spearheading the desperate German lunge were headed straight west to key points when the Eagle Division was hurriedly ordered to stop the advance. How effectively this was done will be written in history, not alone our division's glorious history, but in world history." You know, men like us can make a difference, not only in the history of the United States, but in world history. And I'm talking about all of us collectively. Take the rest of this ride with me this morning, and I'll explain what I'm telling you. Not only in our glorious history, but in world history. The Germans actually did surround us. Their radios blurred our doom. Their commander demanded our surrender in the following impudent arrogance: to the United States of America commander of the encircled town of Bastogne. The fortune of the war is changing. This time, the USA forces in and near Bastogne have been encircled by strong German armored units. There's only one possibility to save the encircled USA troops from total annihilation, and that is your honorable surrender. In order to think it over, a term of 2 hours will be granted, beginning with the presentation of this note. If the proposal should be rejected, the German artillery corps and the heavy AA battalions are ready to annihilate the U.S. troops in and near Bastogne. The order for firing will be given immediately within 2 hours' term after the presentation of this note. All serious civilian casualties and loss of lives by artillery fire would not correspond with the well-known American humanity. Signed, the German commander. The German commander received the following reply, December 22nd, 1944. Nuts. Signed, the American commander. Allied troops, listen to this last paragraph from this great leader. Allied troops are counterattacking in force. We continue to hold the Bastogne. And by holding the Bastogne, we assure the success of the Allied armies. We know that our division commander, General Taylor, will say, well done. We are truly giving our country and our loved ones at home a worthy Christmas present. And being privileged to take part in this gallant feat of arms, we are truly making for ourselves a Merry Christmas. Commander McAuliffe. Boy, is that a letter to the troops? Is that a letter to the troops? Boy, it's one we need now today from our commander, Jesus Christ. Endure hardship with me as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. It's not religion as usual anymore. I know that from the temperature in Washington. It's a time where people are deciding what kind of men they truly are. I just met with a bunch of leaders, and I ran this by our Redskins coaching staff last Friday morning. We have a Bible study out at Redskins Park. The Harvard Business Review just did a study and compressed down to 4 reasons why leaders fail. 4 reasons why they fail. Number one. By the way, I just ran this by a Fulbright scholar from Harvard, and he says, boy, I haven't heard that study, but that's right on. Number one, they became authoritarian. By the way, when I read this, you're going to be thinking of a boss or two you've had, or somebody's going to be thinking of you, most likely. They became authoritarian, controlling, demanding, not listening to those around them, not willing to flex or adapt due to input from others. Two, they became autonomous. Aloof, lonely, isolated, having few relationships and little accountability. Three, they became arrogant, feeling and acting as if they were superior, critical of others, belittling others, and when threatened, they responded with powering up through the use of shame, guilt, and fear. If you try to approach a man like that, he tries to shame you, intimidate you, or make you feel guilty about something. Authoritarian, autonomous, and arrogant. This was very interesting. Number four, 3 words. They committed adultery. Isn't that one interesting? This sinks leaders right here. Malcolm Muggeridge said that men are trapped in the dark, deep dungeons of their own egos. I don't know of anything that can reverse this except a humbling of ourselves before Almighty God. And a dependence on Jesus Christ to get us where we want to go and give us a love and a courage that we don't have. It's funny, when I went through this with the Redskins coaches, I got down to that adultery part, and our coach just went, oh! I said, no, wait, coach, you don't seem like the adulterous type to me. He said, I'm not. I'm just thinking of my wife, Pat. He said, that really would be the death of me right there. She said, if I ever committed adultery, she'd most certainly forgive me right after my funeral service. You know, there's a price to pay for choosing ourselves. In every instance, these leaders fail because they choose themselves. You know, there's an additional study tacked onto this done by the Fuller Institute Seminary out in California. Professor Bobby Clinton, professional leader in the World Missions Department of Fuller Theological Seminary, did extensive work on why Christian leaders fail. And look how close the two really are. These traits are universal. One, misuse of finances. These are supposed to be our shepherds. Two, the abuse of power and authority. They were authoritative, making unilateral decisions, powering up to get their own agenda accomplished. The more charismatic and personality the leader is, the more abusive and manipulative they become. The issue of pride. This may be seen as the fundamental sin out of which all other sins flow. They rarely receive feedback, accountability, correction from others, and when they did receive feedback, they argued against it. Blame shifting, rationalization, self-denial. 4, sexual failures. 5, family problems. 6 was very interesting, plateauing. They just ceased to grow. You know, Richards mentioned, even through this group, you can get with a band of brothers and be stimulated and challenged to get out of your comfort zone and grow. Now, you could just go butt sit in church if you wanted to, not being critical, just analytical. But you're not going to be an airborne ranger. You know, my father was a ranger, and the men that Commander McAuliffe wrote to are right here on the cover of this copy of Stephen Ambrose's book, Band of Brothers. Those are the Screaming Eagles, members of the 101st Airborne. I've given this talk all over the country, and I will tell you, men, on 3 occasions I've had old men hobble up to me. I remember a fellow recently in Los Angeles hobbled up to me after my talk and kissed me on the cheek. Tears coming down his eyes, he said, son, you keep preaching it. That's the way those guys were. You know who he was? Member of the Screaming Eagles. He said, I was in the 101st. I was one of the band of brothers. I really want to encourage you. If you want to get out of your comfort zone and do something to help, you better get with a band of brothers. I think Richard can, some of these brothers here can show you the way. But I'd like to make a few comments on what makes the difference in a man. You take a look at yourself. The men of Easy Company, the 506 Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne, came from different backgrounds, different parts of the country. They were farmers, coal miners, men, sons of the Deep South. Some were desperately poor, and others were from the middle class. Only one came from Harvard, one from Yale, a couple from UCLA. But by and large, they were just citizen soldiers, just regular guys like you and me. They came together the summer of 1942, by which time the Europeans had been at war for 3 years. By late spring 1944, they'd become an elite company of airborne light infantry. Early on the morning of D-Day, here's their first day on the job, what did they do? Early on the morning of D-Day, its first combat action, Easy Company captured and put out of action a German battery of 405-millimeter cannons looking right down on Utah Beach. Well, thank God for that. Since my father was there, I don't think I'd be here today. Neither would you. This is my son, unless you somehow figured how to skip 2 generations. That means something personally to me that they took those cannons out. Here's some other things that these men got accomplished during their race. What are you getting done during yours? They led their counteroffensive at the Battle of the Bulge, fought in the Rhineland campaign, led the way through the Carentan, and at the end of the war, these are the guys that captured Hitler's Eagle's Nest. You know what makes a man like that tick? Briefly, I've been through all of Ambrose's material, and I think I've compressed it down to a few paragraphs. See where you weigh in on this, fellas. 1, they were special in their values. They put a premium on physical well-being and a hierarchical of authority. What would that mean to me? I'm real clear who my commander-in-chief is. It's Christ. I love men, but I don't fear them and I don't kiss up to them. I serve them, but my commander is the Lord. That's the first thing you got to settle, fellas, is who's the commander? And I rate in God's army, I'm probably a corporal. I'm not an officer. I like being where the men are. I'm one of those grunts out in the field with a cigar in his mouth. I know we have great Christians that, you know, are in London telling the rest of us, sitting around a fire smoking Lucky Strikes, what to do. But I think if I got promoted in God's army to be an officer, they'd just bust me right back down to where I am. I like where I am. They were special in their values. They put a premium on hierarchical of authority, and they wanted to be part of an elite unit. See, this is, in the world of Christendom, this is really what separates the winners from the also-rans. They wanted to be a part of an elite unit. That's one reason that I decided to go to Alabama. I wasn't an All-American anything. I'm sure I was the last guy they signed. I had an appointment to the Air Force Academy. Wanted to fly jets and get the bad guys. But our recruiting trip was so whacked out. We watched Alabama kill somebody during the game. I'd never even seen an Alabama game. I was an Air Force kid. Kenny Staber was the quarterback. Then we got on a Bluebird school bus under the stadium. You know what those things are? This is not a luxury coach. And I was sitting with Terry Beasley, a guy that eventually went to Auburn, and we went out to Coach Bryant's house. There was no buffet, nobody kissing up to us, just Cokes and potato chips. That was it. And the old man came in and basically said, if you want to go airborne, this is where you do it. And it just drew me in like I can't tell you. I don't think I contributed very much to the Alabama football program for sure. But it meant a lot to me. Even prepared me for the ministry with men, because I call men to be real men, not religious pansies. Please don't think I'm being critical. You all know what I'm talking about. Well, let's finish our race here today. They wanted to be part of an elite unit. They were idealists, eager to merge themselves into a group fighting for a cause. They actively sought an outfit that they could identify, join, be part of, and relate to as a family. They took it upon themselves to find a band of brothers to join up with. They decided to jump out of airplanes and become airborne Rangers for two profound reasons. I want you to know, the Rangers were all volunteer. You volunteer to get in. And you know when you get to get out? Anytime you want. Anytime that light turns green and they open the door and you don't feel like jumping anymore, you're out. They only want the guys that really want to be in there, if you follow what I'm saying. In Robert Rader's words, the desire to be better than the other guy took hold. Each man in his own way had gone through what Richard Winters experienced, a realization that doing his best was a better way of getting through than hanging around with the sad excuses for soldiers that they encountered in the recruiting depot. Second, they knew they were going into combat. They didn't want to go in with poorly trained, poorly conditioned, poorly motivated draftees on either side of them. As to choose between being a paratrooper, spearheading an offensive, and an ordinary infantryman with an attitude who you couldn't trust, they decided the greater risk was with the infantry. When the shooting started, they wanted to be able to look up to the guy beside them and know they could trust him. Now, isn't that amazing? Here these guys volunteer to jump out of a plane behind enemy lines, run across an open field while they assemble their weapons. But because they were with the best of the best, they felt they were taking the less risk. Now here it is. This is to the part of the talk where I'm going to draw this together and bring it in for a landing. And hope you have a takeaway to really think about that can be life-defining. All of these leaders that fail were selfish. Did you pick up that trend in the Harvard study? All about them. The difference between these airborne Rangers and the draftees is this. It's a way of thinking. The Airborne Rangers are saying, you know, I want my time in the Army to be constructive, productive. I want to be one of the guys that helps win this thing. Hitler completely underestimated these bands of brothers. He had the Hitler Youth. But our guys, somebody had the sense enough in World War II, they organized these men into little families, and they became families, and their power was exponentiated. You get in a little group of guys that want to go airborne with their faith and try to do something, whatever it is, and your power will exponentiate. The Bible says if one can chase 1,000, two can chase 10,000. Isn't that something? Now, the draftee's only goal was just to cover his butt till the war was over. I know a lot of guys, their Christian faith, that's about all it is. They're just covering their rear end of this thing's over, and they hope they get into heaven. Nothing against them. I'll be their buddies. I might even play golf with them or something, but that's not a man I look up to. It's not a man I'm going to criticize. I can't judge why a man chooses one thing and another, but I'm just telling you, as for me, that's not the way I want to spend what time I have left. I want my core group of guys to be guys that aren't ashamed of the Lord, guys that are grateful to the Lord. And it's the guys with the grateful hearts that do the most. They just want to do something. They're compelled. When I coached, I used to love the kids. I couldn't make quit. You just couldn't make them quit. We'd find a place for them to play. I want to share the thing that I'm most grateful to the Lord for, that I feel I'd pay any price back to him for doing this for me, and then I'll close. There is a story in the Bible that Jesus told about a man who was not an airborne ranger, who just lived for himself. Now, I want you to know, in this Harvard study, they estimate that only 30% of leaders finish well, picking up speed when they cross the finish line. Will that be only 30% of you? Statistically, maybe, unless all of you are part of the 30%. 40% limp across the line, and 30 never even finish. That's a motivator for me. That's what they say in the Marines, sir. That's a motivator. I want to finish my race. I'll pay for it, and I want to be picking up speed at the finish line. However God leads us all, that's his business. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just telling you who you ought to be. Just giving you the menu. Like they say at Fox, I report, you decide. Now, this man, in a brief story Jesus told, chose himself again and again. Maybe some of you fellas are maybe doing that. Jesus said there was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen. He fared sumptuously every day. But there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, full of sores, who was laid at his gate, desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. Maybe you're familiar with this story. And so it was the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died. You know, there is an end to this game for all of us. The rich man also died, was buried, and being in torment in hell, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. This guy died and woke up in hell. When's the last sermon you heard about hell? That's the one thing they don't want to tell you about. I had a guy in Washington tell me yesterday, well, I just don't think I believe in hell. I said, well, you probably won't be there 3 seconds before you entirely change your mind, buddy. He's following me around the rest of the day. Now, for you doubters, let's just say maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I sure as hell don't want to find out and be on the wrong end of that. Now, I'm crossing the finish line. Get this last point. The rich man died, and being in agony in hell, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. Then he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me. Send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue. I'm tormented in this flame. But Abraham, who is representative of the Lord here, said, no, son, remember, in your lifetime, you had everything. You know, according to Jesus, and this puts a healthy fear in my heart, according to Jesus, do you know what we don't lose in hell? Is our memory. Boy, you can think of a bad loss at the end of the season, and the answer is, well, I'll have the whole off season to think about this one. How about eternity to think about how you blew it? Stayed a draftee your whole life and then died and woke up in hell. I have a lady that speaks 7 languages in Washington, and I give her word studies. I said, you know, Jesus used 2 words a lot, the word lost and the word perish. Could you tell me what those really mean? I don't want to go to seminary 5 years. You just tell me. That's my plan. She did this study and came back and sat in my living room, and I tell you, when I heard this, I said, God, I'll give anything not to end up like this. Anything. And I consider it an honor to be airborne, if that's what it takes. She said, when you're lost, you may not be where you're supposed to be, but the clock's still on you. You got time to turn it around. Like maybe some of us here today, you may be lost as an Easter egg. Maybe you know you are, maybe you don't know. I was. We all get our turn at the wilderness, don't we? But there's time to fix it. She said, when you perish, it's this guy right here. And here's what she said. The word perish, which Jesus used, means this. To be in solitary isolation, in increasing, continually, multiplying, abundant aloneness forever. Maybe it's what scientists call a black hole. It's the opposite of expanding life. It's eternal, imploding, perishing. Now, you know, through the Hubble telescope, they know without a doubt there are black holes. And now they say 70% of the energy out there is negative energy. And the universe is not only, it's not static, it's not only expanding, it's picking up speed. I heard the guy a few months ago from Baltimore who runs this whole Hubble thing. They said, well, what is that negative energy? He said, we don't have a clue. We're back to zero. I thought to myself, would you look at that? Here, this guy never stayed up all night, never shot pool, never dated, never drank beer, never crashed a car. Got 2 PhDs and a master's degrees. Now what he knows, I know. I just didn't describe my early life for you, did I? Well, here's our last part of our last thought today. Don't stop riding yet. Let's see what scientists say about black holes. This is Jesus' definition of hell. A black hole represents the ultimate triumph of gravity. Its role is the regulator of a star's life. When a massive star dies, gravity becomes so strong that the star can't hold itself up. What happens next? We don't know for certain. One possible end to a massive star's life is total collapse. Its tombstone is a black hole. Outside, we can feel the gravity from the hole, but we can't see it because gravity prevents even light from escaping. Black holes contain the strongest gravitational forces known in the known universe. Nothing can escape light from a black hole, not even light. That's why it's called a black hole. Black holes may form when stars are so overwhelmed by the force of their own gravity, they can't keep from collapsing on themselves. A collapsing star shrinks. If its core is massive enough, it keeps shrinking till the surface collapses till the entire star is shrunk to a point. Any light trying to escape to the outside world is sucked back into the central point. No one inside a black hole can communicate. This really scared me because I love being with people, don't you? No one inside of a black hole can communicate with the outside world. They would be cut off from the universe by the event horizon. A black hole's a dead star. It'll never be anything else. It just sits in space, dark, menacing, swallowing up any other matter that comes by. And if that's not bad enough, consider life without light. According to Jesus, hell is a place where we are by ourselves, with our memories. No one knows you're there. You can't communicate out. No one communicate in. And it works like this. You choose yourself. You choose yourself. You choose yourself. And finally, you know what the Lord says? Well, you know what? You got it. I sat on my couch, and I've been teaching this stuff for 30-something years. I thought, God, I don't want to do that. And I'm so motivated to choose God and others first, because heaven's the opposite of a black hole. You wake up in hell, you have all questions, no answers. Now, I'm going to have a prayer for you, for all of us. Some of you may feel like, you know, I've heard messages, and I feel like I listen to Jerry, the light's green, the door's open, we're over enemy territory, and I want to jump. But I felt like this before. Let me give you one last little motivation to get out the plane. A few years ago, I was in Paris counseling naval personnel at our embassy there, doing family counseling with them. A naval commander said, could we do anything for you, Jerry? You've been pouring your heart out to us. I said, yeah. I want to go to Omaha Beach. I want a driver in one of those cars, and I want y'all to just drive me over there. He could have said no. He asked, so I just started saying stuff, like asking every girl on campus for a kiss. You might get a few, you know? He said, no problem. Sunday, I was at Omaha Beach, and the Marine colonel, who was our historian, that's the curator of the cemetery there on the bluff at Omaha Beach, was the one that told Steven Spielberg where they all went when they made that movie, Saving a Private Ryan. He took me over there and said, well, here's where they landed, Jerry. The tide was out, must have been almost a quarter of a mile to the water to the cliff. I said, good Lord, how did they do this? He said, well, here it is. This battle took 2 years to plan, and it needed four major components, 16-inch shells, air cover, weather, and so on. All four failed. First wave that came in, West Point, enlisted officers, cream of the cream, wiped out. Second wave, junior officers, enlisted men, and CBs, pinned down. The story was getting worse, not better. I never knew that. I said, how did we win this? He said, it's simple. Those men realized that day on that beach there were only two kinds of men on that beach. Dead men, and men who were going to get off that beach. They organized themselves into little bands, designated leaders, and they got moving. And they got the hell off that beach. Now, some of you men may feel, I've been pinned down. I'm pinned down. Life's got me pinned down. You get with some guys. Find some guys you can look up to and trust to lead you, and you get off the beach. Or you know what? You're dead. This is our hour, fellas. You're not here by accident. Let's go airborne. Let me have a prayer. We'll be dismissed. Lord, I pray you have met with us today. This is not a religious talk. This is ultimate reality. You stand around a gravesite, it is ultimate reality. Lord, don't know how much time we have left. This isn't a scary message. This is just a message of reality. Lord, I don't want to choose myself and be in a black hole with me and myself. I've decided I'm not a big deal. I don't want to be left alone with my memories of me forever. I'm going to quit that and give it up. Lord, help us go airborne wherever our faith is. Maybe there are some here who said, I've never even crossed the line. I don't have a uniform. I've never enlisted. We'll do it. If you have sense enough to run around with these people, buy a car, make money, you have sense enough how to give your life to Christ. Just do it. Make him your commander in chief. Lord, thank you for all those that have gone before. All those that have paid the price so that we can enjoy this Christmas. Help these men make a worthy place here in their hometown, here in this country and in this world, for their loved ones and friends to live. Lord, let us go airborne and help win the war. In Christ's name, amen. All right, give them heaven, guys. That beats the alternative.